Good morning and welcome to Mid-Coast Currents for April 17th, 2015. I'm Amy Brown, filling in as host this month. We've got a treat in store for you today as we bring you an event called Salted Tales, Stories from the Sea Told Live, that was held in Belfast in late March. Salted Tales was a joint venture of the Penobscot Marine Museum and the Colonial Theatre where the event was held. The Colonial's Mike Hurley and Kathy Goldner from the Penobscot Marine Museum were the MCs.
My name is Mike Hurley. I'm with the Colonial Theatre, and thank you all for coming. This is Kathy Goldner, and I'm going to let Kathy speak first. Kathy's with the Penobscot Marine Museum.
Thank you all so much for coming today. We are absolutely thrilled to be part of this. And thank you so much, Mike. Mike has organized it and done a fantastic job. I don't know, last summer, I think, I was standing in the Tozier's parking lot, and Mike called out to me across the parking lot, "Hey, do you guys want to do a sea story thing?" And I said, "Yes, we do." So here we are. Maine, as you all know, has an amazing maritime cultural heritage. One of the unique things about Maine is that all up and down this amazing coast are these beautiful little 19th century towns that were all built with shipping and ship building money. We tell the story of that at the museum, so please come. 3 acres, 12 buildings. We open May 23rd. We'd love to see you. But it's an amazing maritime heritage that that still exists with us today. We don't always realize because in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, Maine was building these little towns were building hundreds of boats. People were sailing ships and sailing all around the world. That still happens today. From Maine Maritime Academy to Bath Iron Works, all the little boat builders up and down the coast. The past here in Maine is prologue, and that's one reason we're doing this today. Thank you so much.
By the time I was 10, I had sailed across the Atlantic. I had spent 70 days sailing across the Atlantic, seven trips because I was born in Germany with my mother, who happened to be there. My father was doing post-war construction, and we swam in a welded-up gun emplacement. I got locked into a bathroom where all I could remember was an acetylene torch coming through the bathroom door. I don't know if that had anything to do with my interest in the ocean, but 15, 20 years later, I found myself crossing over Lake Michigan on the Badger, which is the last coal-fired vessel on the Great Lakes. It was a big rail carrying and trucks and cars, and it's still running today. And I saw one of the seamen there, and I said, "So, how do you get a job here?" And I was in between jobs, like way between jobs. And he said, "Oh, well, Labor Day, all the college kids get off this ship and there will be work. But what you gotta do is come to the Seaman Hall in Ludington, Michigan, and you sit there and they will not wanna give you a job. And you have to sit there until they give you a job. And just don't say a thing, no matter what anybody says, don't leave, and you'll get a job." And so Labor Day, or day after Labor Day, I presented myself in this thing that was like a setting out of a movie with a giant sort of labor mural of seamen union guys beating each other up. And then I sat there for a week, and this guy who looked like Al Capone with a hat and a suit would walk by me and not even look at me. And the lady would type and dust would float in the room. And like at 4:45 on Friday, the guy's walking out and he stops and he goes, "Go up to the Coast Guard, get your papers." And so I ran up to the Coast Guard and got my papers. And then I worked on the Badger, and I actually just dug out my card. So that's a little story of how I got my Z card. And I was looking at it, 135 pounds. With a complexion they called ruddy. Okay, that's my C story. I'm going to introduce Rick Cronin, who's a great old friend of mine. And Rick is going to set the stage here for listening to C stories. And by way of introduction, Rick took his first sailing job. He was looking for a ride to Europe. And I'll bet you many, many sailors and seamen can really relate to that waiting for that first job, because they're not going to... They give the job to the guys who are, or the women who are already have their licenses. And so he waited, and he finally got on at the Brooklyn Scandinavian Seamen's Union Hall to try and get a free ride to Europe, and had to work 3 months to get there, stopping in Newark, Savannah, New Orleans, Houston, Galveston, Libya, and finally on to Hamburg. Yeah, he took 12 years to design jewelry, go and teaching at Pratt. He kept driving by the Brooklyn shipyards and he kept thinking about those ships. 1981, he went back to MMA, or not back, he went to MMA as an old man and graduated with a third mate's license, lives here in Belfast, and he sailed for 29 years on tugs, the main ferry service. He's leaving out the Kate up on Moosehead Lake, and also oil tankers. And when he wasn't sailing, he was painting. If you ever saw the big mural in Belfast that on the back of the IGA, all the fruit jars, that was Rick's work. He's a fishing columnist for Penn Bay Pilot, and he says here he loses money to me at poker, but I wish it was true. Anyway, he is now retired. His son John is here, his wife Susan, who's got lots of stories of her own. And John is now second generation merchant marine working on a drilling rig in the Gulf of Mexico. So I want to welcome Rick Cronin.
Thanks, Mike. 1969. Like Mike said, I went to sea on a tramp freighter. It was the Kirsten Skoe. It was a classic two-house stick ship registered in Denmark. I sat in a union hall in Brooklyn, New York, as Mike said, waiting for a job to be put on the board that no one else would take. That first job was as a hovmestermet. The steward's mate, it was a messman. I made $7 a day. Later, I sailed on tugs up and down the East Coast. I made a little more money. I went as far south as Honduras. Went as far north as Ontonagon, Michigan, on the Upper Peninsula, on Lake Superior. Then I drove the Kate, the Katahdin, on Moosehead Lake for 3 years for the Moosehead Marine Museum right here in Maine. And then for the next 25 years, I sailed on a series of oil tankers all over the world. One of those ships you would have heard of, the Exxon Valdez. We drank a lot. We drank a lot of coffee. As a deck officer on a tanker, I spent a lot of time on the bridge with a couple of other sailors. We were the watch. That was our job. We watched and we listened. The lookout would be out on the bridge wing where he could hear as well as see. He was out there in the weather and would change positions hourly with the helmsman. The three of us spent our time looking into the dark, hoping not to see something unexpected. A poorly lit sailboat, fishing boat that made a bad radar target. Mostly, we were up there out there by ourselves, alone. So we had time to talk and to drink coffee. And the sailors, their stories were entertaining. So my job was, I was a professional listener. It was a great job. You've all paid $5 to come in here and listen to sea stories. I got to do it and got paid for it. My favorite watch was the second mate's watch, the 4 to 8. I'd get up at about 3 o'clock in the morning. I would take a shower and shave, and I would head for the bridge. And when I arrived at about 20 to 4, the coffee would be dripping. Sailors use a lot of memory devices in their work. I'm sure some of you have heard Red, Right, Return for keeping track of buoys, or worm and parcel with the lay, turn and serve the other way. One of the most important is if the grounds are cold, the coffee's old. So on a good ship, you could always get a fresh hot cup of coffee on the bridge. So I'd take my cup of coffee and I'd go out on the bridge wing. I'd allow my eyes to become accustomed to the dark and check the weather and the sea conditions. I'd scan the horizon for lights. Then by about 10 to 4, I would be back in the wheelhouse. I would have put a position on the chart. I would have checked the radars to make sure that there was no traffic that I needed to deal with. Then I'd relax and begin listening to stories. The stories that the sailors told, they had a lot of practice at them, and some of them became quite good storytellers. They had done a lot with their lives, typically, besides going to sea. I sailed with a guy that could sing all the songs of the Pirates of Penzance. I sailed with a guy who had managed his wife's boxing career. She was the Fighting Cherokee, and they had a pretty scrappy romance. He had married her on two different occasions. I sailed with a refugee from Africa who had stowed away with seven others and made it safely and undetected to New York City in a shipping container. I sailed with a Las Vegas blackjack dealer. I sailed with a guitar player who toured with Little Richard in his backup band. I sailed with a prison guard that had kept Charlie Manson under lock and key in West Virginia. A bunch of part-time bartenders. One of them had thrown Janis Joplin out of his father's bar in Port Arthur, Texas when she was a teenager. I sailed with cowboys and even with cattle rustlers. There was one guy that could recite all of Maggie's Boyle, a Robert Service poem. There were a lot of stories of financial schemes and disasters, family farms that were failed and went away, a busted ukulele business. Some of the stories were very personal. I sailed with a guy once that never took his vacation, his paid leave. So I asked him one time why he never took his paid leave. And he said, you know, I used to go home and my wife, she would never cook. Every night we went to McDonald's. Finally, I complained, and she took me to Burger King. He said, I really liked McDonald's better than I liked Burger King, and the food's pretty good on the ship, so I pretty much stopped going home. And that was typical of a lot of sailors. A lot of them were more at home on ships than they were ashore. So sea stories, they don't always have to be high adventure. They don't have to begin with, and this is no sh. They don't all end with, and it's been fucked up ever since. For me, a sea story is a story told by a sailor. It can be told in a bar, it can be told in the wheelhouse of a ship, or it can be told in a movie theater. I retired a couple of years ago, and I'm really looking forward to hearing these sea stories tonight. The first storyteller is an old friend of mine. He makes a terrific fish chowder. He's a bit of a chowder himself, a man of many parts, Along with his cooking skills, he's been a farmer, tugboat captain, a schemer, a sailor, a sailing ship captain. He's run day tours out of Belfast Harbor. He's been a bosun on oil tankers. He can survey your boat and fix your Volvo. He and his wife, Julie, have raised two spectacular children. He and I first sailed together on the Christina. He was an engineer and I was the mate. He kept that ancient tugboat running all the way to Honduras and back. Welcome, Stephen Olson.
Well, I got some counseling on what kind of a story to tell. I was planning on telling about the night when Rick Cronin and I both got seasick for the first time in our lives. It was a colorful tale involving going around Cape Hatteras in January, and the highlight was a geyser of sewage shooting out of the head. And my wife suggested that maybe I should tell you a different story. So I'm going to do that. I'm not going to tell you the story about going by Cape Hatteras on the Christina on Christmas Eve in terrible weather with Rick Cronin, because he was a circus juggler at one point, juggling two oranges and an apple while the boat just rolled like a barrel. Anyway, this is a story about 1991 in April when I was sailing as bosun. I had just been appointed bosun on an old, beautiful old steam tanker called the King. And I won't describe it beyond that. But we were headed south from New York Harbor. I had just unloaded 6 million gallons of gasoline. And I was getting used to, you know, my life. She was the first ship I ever worked on, sailing as an able-bodied seaman. And she was an incredibly hard-working ship. One trip I was on for 142 days, and during that time, she was either underway or working cargo for 141 of them. And I know, and 142 days, I was not capable of going longer. I started talking to myself. And she was an old-fashioned ship with all of the dock lines were 600-foot fiber dock lines. They did not roll up neatly on drums. They were dragged down the deck and coiled down by hand, she was what's called a product carrier or a clean oil tanker, and we would switch from cargo to cargo. And on this particular trip, we had just unloaded heating oil, and it was right at during the desert storm, and we were in theory under charter to to go down to Baton Rouge and load a cargo of military, what was called moon fuel, which was the fuel that the very high altitude surveillance planes could burn at like 60,000 feet. And the amount of cleaning that had to go into these tanks to get them ready for a cargo of moon fuel was fairly extensive. And so we went through the whole process of getting unhooked from our cargo lines, getting the manifold closed off, getting the dock lines in, getting the tugboats made up alongside, all of this stuff preparatory to actually getting underway. And these old ships, the King, when she came out, sailed with a crew of 50, and there were 26 of us on board. And so when they tell you about how hard they used to work in the old days, well, I don't know what they were working at, but anyway, we got out in the ocean, headed south, and the next day, my normal day would be at 6 a.m. I'd go up to the wheelhouse and have a cup of coffee with the chief mate, who was my boss. He's the king of the deck, and He's never called the chief mate. He's just called the mate. And because he's the guy that everybody, all the deck revolves around. So we're talking, he says, okay, well, after breakfast, get set up to blow tanks, which is a question of all these steam hoses hooked into our steam system, because this is actually a steamship. She wasn't a diesel. And then we would take plates up off the deck, and which all had to be done by hand because the ship was still full of vapor, and a spark from a power tool could have blown the decks off the ship. And so we got that going, and these blowers you set down and they just howl like banshees, and they're blowing down some of these deck plates that you take off, and other deck plates are just pouring fuel vapors out on deck and, you know, over the rails and away. And we're getting ready to this ship had 27 tanks. And so everyone, you had to open covers and then move these blowers and sit there with a cargo monitor until they were showing that they were free of vapor, and then we'd move to the next tank. And we get this done. The mate comes and says, all right, you get that done. Start getting the gear out for washing tanks, which is hundreds and hundreds of feet of fire hose, which you hooked into the hot water system on deck, and then these things that are giant rotating spray heads that you would then drop down through these open manholes, and they'd go down 10 feet for 20 minutes and then 30 feet for 40 minutes. And it was all this huge book about cleaning the tanks telling you where to drop these machines down. And then you'd have to pull them back, you know, and they're it was a lot of work and a lot of heat between the steam hoses and the hot water. And I said to the mate, you know, we got the blowers going, everything's fine, we got 4 days to clean tanks. Maybe we could just blow tanks today. And I can stay out on deck, and I just need a couple of guys to help me move blowers once an hour. The rest of the time, we can just take the day off. And he just looked at me, and he said, what? And I said, mate, we went into New Jersey on Christmas Eve, tied up at 10 o'clock, worked cargo all night. Santa flew right over us. And the next day, we were empty and underway again at 10 o'clock on Christmas night, and nobody got a moment off. And here it is, it's Easter. And he just looks at me and he goes, Easter? And I said, yeah, it's Easter. And he goes, well, I said, the guys are tired. And you just looked at him, and he was just like totally blank on that idea, because chief mates are never tired. Chief mates, they are like a breed apart. They want to be captains, and they will walk through fire to become captains. And the fire is being chief mate and carrying the whole ship around on your back. And he just looks at me, and he goes, friggin' Easter? And I said, yeah, we could take the day off, kind of. Not really, but part of the day off. And at this time, we had kind of gotten in along because we were going south. The Gulf Stream is coming north, and we were working our way south on the inside, up on the continental shelf, and the Gulf Stream spins off these eddies, warm core eddies going up on the shelf, and then the cold water from the shelf coming out in the stream. And so the second mate was up in the wheelhouse kind of steering us around to catch these eddies, which would give us a little boost in speed. And the King was a wonderful ship, but she was not exactly a speed burner. And a two-knot current was a big deal. And so One of the things about the edge of the Gulf Stream is that there are just thunderheads. You know, you can tell where the edge of the stream is just because of a line of rain squalls and thunderstorms. And we're going along, and the mate's looking at me going, I can't believe it. I hired you as bosun, and you want to give everybody the day off. And he goes, Easter. And I said, mate, yeah, Easter. And at the exact moment, the ship was struck by lightning. And it was not hit like something across the valley that you see. It was like, and we're both sitting there looking at each other, and we're both perfectly aware that these blowers are just piling fuel vapors up out of the hatches. And we look up, we were up on the foredeck, and we look up at the wheelhouse, and the second mate and the captain are looking down at us. And I'm looking at the mate, and in that moment, I saw exactly what he looked like when he was 7 years old. His face was just a blank, and I'm sitting there going, oh, man, I do not want to die. And we're going along, and the seconds rolled by, and it became apparent we're not going to die. The ship is not going to blow up. And he just looks at me, and he goes, Easter, huh? And I said, yeah. And he said, all right, keep the pumps running.
You're listening to Mid-Coast Currents on WERU-FM. These stories were told at an event called Salted Tales, Stories from the Sea Told Live, that was held in Belfast in late March. Salted Tales was a joint venture of the Penobscot Marine Museum and the Colonial Theater, where the event was held. The Colonial's Mike Hurley and Kathy Goldner from the Penobscot Marine Museum were the MCs.
Our next storyteller is Mac Smith. Mac is a Navy veteran of the first Gulf War and is a former new reporter for the Bar Harbor Times. He currently lives in the town of Stockton Springs in the village of Sandy Point, where he is restoring the family homestead. Mainers on the Titanic, published last year by Down East Books, is his first book. Thank you for coming, Mac.
Thank you for being here today, ladies and gentlemen. I make my living by telling one of the greatest sea stories ever told, Titanic. My book, Mainers on the Titanic, chronicles the lives of the people of Maine who were aboard the doomed ocean liner. Though there were roughly 14 Maine families aboard Titanic, I want to tell the story of Edith White of Brunswick. Edith would stay behind in Maine, as she saw her husband, Percival Sr., and her son, Richard, off on the Olympic, one of Titanic's two sister ships, to travel to Europe in 1911. Richard was a student at Bowdoin College, and as 1911 wound down, Richard finished his four-year college career a semester early. Richard had been ostracized at Bowdoin. He was slightly built, highly intelligent, and somewhat pretentious, had a speech impediment, and he was seen only on campus for classes, not for socialization, spending the rest of his time at his Brunswick home with his family. The Bowdoin Bugle, the college's yearbook, published before Richard's death, made fun of him in the way he preferred to say things like infinitesimal particles of saline humective fluidity rather than little drops of water. Richard was worn out from his extra college work. His father took him to Europe in the winter of 1911 so that Richard could rest. Percival also wanted to reward Richard for his early college completion, so for the return voyage home, at which time graduation activities would begin, Percival booked passage for the both of them on the maiden voyage of the Titanic. After the sinking, before Carpathia's arrival, the Brunswick Record published a small article stating that Richard and Percival's names were not on the survivor list that was slowly being wired to shore. Edith traveled to Boston to be with her other son, Percival Jr., a reporter for the Boston Post. Too distraught to attend Carpathia's arrival, Edith instead sent two of Percival Sr.'s brothers to meet the rescue ship. As Carpathia emptied, there was no sign of Percival Sr. or Richard, and at last the worst was known, that they had not survived. As the days passed after Carpathia's arrival, much was learned about the last moments of the other passengers in first class who did not survive. But not much was known about Percival Sr. and Richard's last moments, as they were private people. The only story that came back to Edith was that Percival Sr. was often seen on deck without a hat on, which was a social indiscretion of the time. Edith was in agony. She needed to know how her husband and son had spent the last moments of their life. She sent out a questionnaire to all of Titanic survivors, along with a photograph of father and son, asking if anyone had seen them in their last moments, if either of them had sent a message home to their family. There were but a few responses in the affirmative. The few they did receive hopefully gave great comfort to Edith White. One was from Mrs. Elizabeth Lines, who was traveling alone with her young daughter, Mary. During the voyage, Mary was scared of the water, and Richard would spend considerable time playing the mandolin for her to occupy her and keep her calm. Another passenger was Mrs. Jean Hippick, who was traveling alone with her mother. She said that the foursome spent a lot of time playing a game called Whist, which was a popular game at the time. After Titanic hit the iceberg, Percival Sr. and Richard would escort the Hippicks to a lifeboat, but make no attempt to enter themselves as other men did, instead spending their time helping others into the lifeboats. She said Percival had a bottle of wine with him and gave Mrs. Hippick and her mother each a drink. It made mother feel stronger, and I'm very sure it is what kept mother up during the dreadfully long night, wrote Mrs. Hippick to the new widow. Percival's body was never found. Richard's was found a week or so after Titanic sank, and at the time that, as soon as the news came that his body had been found, Bowdoin College organized a beautiful tribute to their fallen brother. At that ceremony, and at graduation a few months later, the attitudes of the men of the class of 1912 had changed towards their awkward, lisping classmate. Men of the class of 1912, we have the highest example life can furnish to measure up to, and the noble death of one of our number must bear fruit in our lives, eulogized Frank A. Smith, who just a few months earlier had gone to Halifax to identify Richard's body. So wherever we go, to whatever work we are called, whether great or small, may we too catch Dick White's spirit, said Mr. Smith. And although it's not in the book, I just want to say that I've always hoped that Mrs. White found some comfort in the words from the strangers that were sent to her after the loss of her family. I've always hoped that the change in Richard's classmates' attitudes towards her favorite son gave her comfort. I have always hoped, too, that she found comfort in the advancements in sea safety that came from the loss of her husband, her son, and the other 1,498 people on the morning of April 15, 1912, including the requirement for enough lifeboats to be on board any given vessel to accommodate every person aboard. The requirement that communication systems be staffed 24 hours a day and not just when the attendant was awake. And the creation of the Coast Guard, which keeps an eye on icebergs and such things and renders assistance to those in distress. Yet part of me is glad that she died long before she died in the 1940s. Part of me is glad that she died before she could hear the names of the other ships, the other passengers that still continue to perish at sea to this day. With all the safety mechanisms on ships, the advancements in technology that can allow a ship to sail itself, almost sail itself safely across the Atlantic, humans are still human, and it is still possible for a captain to err in judgment, possible for a captain to flick a switch to turn those safety systems off. It's possible for cruise ships to catch fire at sea. It's possible for ferries in Korea to capsize. I'm glad she never heard the name Concordia. Thank you.
I want to bring up John McMillan, who's been actively involved in the marine and aviation safety survival training industry since the late 1970s. He's conducted water survival training throughout the U.S., internationally, Nigeria, Equatorial Guinea, Africa, Mexico, Chile, and Scotland. And he is the representative, the United States representative to the International Association for Safety and Survival Training, where there are 47 countries involved. John comes from the great state of Louisiana. By the way, he helps our Maine accent here greatly, and is the ocean survival instructor at Maine Maritime. Please bring up John McMillan. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Mike. Mike called me, and I was out in California, in Carpinteria, California, when I got the message that Mike was going to put this together. So he says, I don't really know your background, but we're doing a little sea story, so why don't you come out and tell some sea stories and just have some fun doing it. So I started thinking about my background, and I said, well, I have some offshore oil and gas experience because I'm from Louisiana. I've got some aviation background. I used to work for the company that flew these individuals offshore. I've got some fishing background. I worked for a shrimper down in Louisiana. I did some lobster fishing when I was up here. And I said, well, I've got some firefighting background because I was the assistant chief for Youngsville Fire Department, and we had some stories there. And I said, and then I'm an EMT, so I worked on an ambulance department. And I said, so I could tell some stories there. And then I got to thinking, McMillan, you an old man. I'm thinking, man, you know, I said, how can you do this? So anyway, I got to thinking, in my offshore oil and gas experience, I didn't really have any things that, as Steve had mentioned earlier, when you feel that you're not going to die, it's not survival. It's just a momentary discomfort. So I've never been in a situation where I was thinking, McMillan, this is your judgment day, pal. Good luck to you, and you've had a good life, so off you go. I've never really had that experience. But the story that I would like to share with you happened out in California years ago. I had a very good friend of mine who was the aquatic director for Ventura Community College, and he was a master scuba diver, and he was a water polo referee for the Olympics, and he was just quite an exceptional individual, and he invited me one time to go scuba diving with him. And he said, Johnny, says there's an open space on this boat going out of Ventura, and it's going to be a wonderful dive, and the space came available. So I said, Bill, are you going? He goes, yes, I am. I said, well, then sign me up. So we get there, and there's about eight divers on board, and we're going to be going to a place right outside. You got Carpinteria, then you have Santa Barbara, and then you have Goleta, and then you have El Capitan, and then Refugio State Parks. And that's where we were going to go diving, right off the beach of the state parks, where there's abalone. But also, as the dive master said, there's also seals, which brings in marine life. And there hasn't been any sightings of any dangerous marine life at this time, but there have been spotting of the great white from time to time. But it's not pup season, so don't worry, we'll be safe. So fair enough, we go out, I get in the water, I'm diving, and I'm just paddling nice and easy on the bottom. Next thing you know, I've been underwater for about 45 minutes. I said, well, let me surface to see where the boat is. So I look up, and I can't see the boat. So I'm thinking, well, he wouldn't have left me. So I kind of go a little bit higher, and there in the distance is a speck. And I'm thinking, that's the boat. So I said, well, you're an offshore survival instructor. You're a pretty good swimmer. Just swim back to the boat. So I started swimming for about 15 minutes, and I had made no forward progressive motion. So I'm thinking, you ain't going to make that boat, Macmillan. You're going to be spending the night out here because the sun's going down. I'm thinking the only way they're going to come get you is if that boat comes and gets you. So because you're not going to be swimming there. So I'm thinking, great, I'm going to be spending the night out here. So because the sun's going down. So I'm starting to think, well, what's going to be a cause of death? Well, I'm not going to die of starvation and dehydration. I'm not going to die of hypothermia because I've got a wetsuit on. I got a little bit of extra fat on me, and I know some survival skills. So I'm not going to. That's not going to kill me. I'll drown before I go there. So then I got to thinking, but there's marine life here, and you look like a seal, and the great white, is the ambusher. Everything else, the bull, shark, tiger, sharks, they're surface approachers, but the great white comes from underneath. So I'm thinking, well. There was a man that came to one of my training programs who's a Marine Mammal Institute sharkologist, and he's saying 75% of the people who are bitten, we're not eaten by sharks, we're bitten, are paddling something. So you may be paddling a surfboard, you may be paddling a kayak, you may be paddling one of these things you stand up on, but you're paddling. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm not going to use the elementary backstroke, I'm not going to use the modified breaststroke, I'm not going to look like a food source, I'm going to look like a dog, so I'm going to do the doggy paddle, because I'm not in Louisiana, and alligators go after dogs, so I'm throwing the sharks right off, okay? So I'm figuring this out pretty quickly. So now I'm thinking, all right, start paddling. All right, so then I see the beach where Refugio was, and there's some people on the beach, but it's at a distance, so I'm thinking maybe I'll swim halfway in between there, so if the boat doesn't come, I can make it to the beach. So I look back, and the sun's starting to go down, and I'm thinking, all right, well, you know, you look at these shark encounters where people are bitten by sharks, and most of them are on surfboards, so I said they go for the lower extremity, so I said they hit the legs. So I said, well, if they hit my legs, okay, I'm thinking, my basketball days will be over, but maybe if they just take one leg, I can still play golf. So I'm in this wetsuit. I'm thinking, what leg would I sacrifice? So I'm kind of moving around, and I'm thinking, well, I can balance on this one. I'm swinging in this wetsuit like I'm hitting a golf ball. And I'm thinking, well, realistically, I'm keeping my balance pretty well on either leg, so I'll just sacrifice any leg. So I'm thinking, but you're not on a surfboard, pal. You look like a seal, and normally those sharks go right for the body cavity, so they're going to come up from underneath, and you never know what's going to hit you, and I think that's the way I need to go. I don't want to suffer, right? But then I get thinking, you got a scuba tank on the back, and when that shark comes from underneath, that tank is going to stop it from closing in on you all the way, and the teeth marks are just going to puncture your lungs, and it's going to... It's just going to make life miserable for you. And it's not going to kill you, but it's just going to make it miserable. So then I'm thinking, I'll be damned. I'm fighting back, okay? So I had this knife on my leg. So I'm thinking about this knife, and I'm thinking, I'm going to stab it. That's what I'm going to do. So I'm grabbing this diver's knife. That's, if you've seen a diver's knife, it's not like a Swiss Army knife. It's a pretty, you can build a house with this thing, cut a tree down. And I mean, it's huge. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to hold it like this. And I'm going to hold it like this. No, I'm going to hold it like this. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to grab it because the shark skin, okay, it's got that, it's rough, right? So I'm thinking I'll grab onto it. They fight alligators, so hell, I can fight a shark. I'm going to punch it in the eye, go for the gills, and then go for the gut. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. The eyes, the gills, the gut. Yeah, that's it. So I'm getting ready for this, all right? So then I'm thinking, so now I've successfully killed this shark in my mind. The boat's going to come find me. They're going to take me to Santa Barbara to take a picture in the paper. And here I am holding my shark like this. That's it. And I'm thinking, I'm from Louisiana. We're going to cook this thing, okay? So I'm thinking we can fry some up. We're going to barbecue some. I can marinate it. My brother can do a little jerky because he does deer jerky, shark jerky. I don't know how it's going to taste, but I'm sure my brother would make it good. And then I got the skin, and we're going to make some boots. So I'm going to do shark skin boots, wallets, belts, the teeth. Okay, I'm going to make jewelry for my sister. And you know the little jaws that you have and that you see at the tourist shop? I said, I'm going to take those, and then I'm going to put them in my living room, and I'm going to put my picture of me in Santa Barbara like this in the middle of the jaws. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So So I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, all right. Okay, let's forget all that. Okay, let's start getting back to the boat, McMillan. Okay, so I said, I'm going to swim to the beach. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go in between there. All right? I'm going to shoot the gap. So if the boat can't find me, then I'm going to go to the beach. And I look at the beach, and I see people starting to leave because now the sun's starting to go down. So people starting to leave, and I see Highway 101. I see some headlights on there, so I'm thinking, great, getting kind of dark, so I better start swimming. So I'm thinking, well, if I'm going to swim, I'm going to sing a song. You know, and Waylon Jennings has always been one of my favorite guys. So I'm singing some The Door's Always Open, and I'm singing Amanda. And then all of a sudden, I'm doggy paddling, and I'm on my back. And then I said, well, I'm going to sing the song that turned me on to country music, which was Are You Sure Hank Done It That Away? So I turn, I start doing the doggy paddle. All of a sudden, I see the boat, and it's coming toward me. And it's still in the distance, though, and I'm thinking, maybe they'll see me. So next thing, I'm waving my hands and doing all this, and nothing. Next thing you know, I see the boat stop, and they pick up another diver. So I'm thinking, great, I'm not the only idiot that got out here, you know. So all of a sudden, they start coming back. They're getting closer, and they're getting closer. And I'm waving, and I'm waving, and I still get no response from the wheelhouse. So the captain's not flashing any lights, blowing any whistle, no horns, no sirens, nothing. So I'm still kind of disappointed. I'm still like, they're going to miss me. The sun's going down. So next thing you know, a diver comes out and sees me and waves to me. So I wave back, and I think, oh, thank you, Jesus. They found me. Okay. So the captain pulls up, and he comes out, and he looks down the boat. He goes, hey, John, time to go, pal. You ready to get out the water? Yes, sir. Yeah, yes, I am. Yeah, sure. I get out. So he goes, so I get on the boat. Everybody else is on the boat, right? So I'm the last one out there. So they put down the dive ramp. I take my tanks off. I get up on there and we go in the little wheelhouse, and they had everything. And they're all there talking. Well, I saw Garibaldi. Well, I saw some kelp. Well, I saw these kind of fish. And you think, well, how was your dive, John? What did you see? And I don't want to tell them about my visualizations. You never hallucinate. You just visualize. So I want to say, well, I saw the beach. And I was going for it. You know. I said, so I saw the same thing you saw. You know, nice snails, and saw some abalone, and some kelp, and some Garibaldis, and all that. So then I see this blue ice chest, and the dive master's assistant comes up. He opens up the ice chest, and there's all kind of imported beer, all right? There's the Corona, and there's the Firestone. And I looked at the captain. I said, so can we grab a cold beverage? He goes, yeah, John, sure, that's what they're for. So I grabbed a beer and drank it. I still had salt water in my mouth and taste. So the first one went down well, and then I grabbed another one, opened it up, and I took a sip, and then I started thinking. So what are you going to get your brothers and your sister for Christmas now that you're not going to have those boots? You know? And I started thinking, oh, great. I don't know what to get them now, you know? And I sat there and I started thinking about Christmas gifts. So it made me realize, you know, that sometimes a human mind sometimes can just vent and you actually believe some things that happen to you. But the thought of death, you know, really at that time, I said, well, if it takes me out, it's going to take me out quickly. And that's the way, and I'm going to go that way. And I can just see it in the paper. Offshore survival instructor, you know, dies of cold water survival. I said, no, I'm not going that way. And I said, so it's going to be by marine life encounters. And I said, that's more of a survival instructor way to go out because, well, if you're an instructor, that means you read the book twice and you saw the movie and you passed the test. Okay. So that's how you get there, you know? So anyway, that's my little story, but the concept is like what many people have said, you know, you always encounter things offshore. And when man ventures out to sea, there's always that danger there. And we've been actively involved with safety and survival for many years, knowing that, you know, we think everybody can swim. That's what people say. So, Mr. McMillan, what do you do for a living? I say, well, I teach people how to use Coast Guard and aviation life-saving appliances if they find themselves in the water, some techniques to use with cold water survival, dangerous marine life encounters, swimming through oil and gas, you know, rescue procedures from boat or by helicopter and these type of things. So they look at me and they go, oh, you teach them how to swim. Yes, I do. Yes. And they're very good swimmers. So, thank you very much.
Steve Olson.
It was about 25 years ago.
phone rang at about 9:30 at night, and there was a guy that I'd never talked to before in my life named Francis Farrell, wanting to know if I had some time and was interested in a job. And I said, well, I have some time. What job? And he said, well, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, I don't know. And he said, I need you to take a tugboat to from Portsmouth to Connecticut. And I said, okay. And so at 11 o'clock the next morning, I was there. Francis Farrell was not, but his captain was. And the captain looked at me. I'm looking around this 123-foot tugboat. And he says, do you drink coffee? And I said, no. Well, yeah, I drink some. And he goes, you smoke cigarettes? And I said, no. He said, that's too bad. And I said, why? He said, with these boats, you got to take it slow. Everything goes slow. This is a big, heavy boat. She moves slow. You can't be in a hurry. You can't be jerking on the controls. He said, in fact, there are no controls. And I looked around the wheelhouse, and he was right. There were no controls except for the wheel. And I'm kind of looking at this, and he goes, yeah. He goes, everything's done down the engine room. And you talk to him with these things. And he goes over by the door, and there's two brass handles, a little one and a big one. And he said, this is the jingle. That's the bell. And I go, great. And he goes, when you want to go ahead, you pull on the bell, one bell. And then you go ahead. And I said, okay, I got that. How do you get it to stop? And he said, you pull it again, one bell, and it stops. And I said, so how does that work? And he said, well, if you're going ahead and you pull the bell, then it stops. And if you're stopped, if you pull the bell, it goes forward. And I said, how do you go backwards? And he said, well, you pull the bell till you stop. If you're going ahead, you pull the bell to stop, and then you pull it twice, and then you go astern. And I said, well, then how do you stop it? He said, you pull it once. And I'm kind of, okay. And he said, if you're going ahead and you want to go astern, the best thing to do is to pull it once and they stop, and then pull it twice and they go astern. But you can also pull it just four times and they go astern. But you shouldn't do that. And I said, why not? And he said, well, because the engineers figure you're getting in trouble up there and trying to get yourself out of trouble by making rapid shifts, and they get nervous. I said, okay, we got that. I said, how do you go faster and slower? And he goes, that's what the jingle is for. One jingle is half ahead, two jingles is full ahead. And I said, how do you slow down? And he said, well, if you're going ahead, you pull one bell, and you get slow ahead. And I said, I thought I'd get stop. And he said, no, because you've given it a jingle. And so I'm looking at this kind of going, and he goes, listen, I got to go. It was a very snowy day. He says, I got to drive all the way down to Rhode Island, then I got to be on an airplane tomorrow to go to work. And I said, where? And he said, Puerto Rico. I drive a tug between Canaveral and Puerto Rico. I just do this for fun. And I kind of go, yeah, this looks like a lot of fun. And so he says, yeah, well, how are you going to get off of here? And I said, well, you know, and I said, well, I guess we'll put this line across the front end of the barge, because we were made up on the hip of the barge, tied alongside it. And everything was ready to go, because he had been planning to do the trip when the weather went bad. And so I said, well, we'll do this, we'll do that. And he said, fine, you got it. You're going to do great. So I'm there, and he basically just walks out, and I'm looking around the wheelhouse, and the deckhands had gone out on, because he was going to throw the lines off for us, the offgoing captain, and the deckhands go out with him, and they're standing there in typical deckhand on a snowy day position, with their back to the snow, with their back to the wind. They look like a couple of sheep. And so I'm going, well, there must be engineers down there. And I go over to the bell, and he told me to do this. I jingle it, and I wait for a minute, and it jingles back. Whoa. And so, you know, this tug was built in like 1942, and they originally had this beautiful wheel, but nobody ever uses them anymore. It's just a little jog lever, a little looks like, I don't know what it looks like. It's a little piece of industrial wiring. You go like that. And so I put it over this way a little bit, and wait a minute. This is the tug Ocean King alongside Portsmouth Naval Yard, ready to get underway with a barge going downriver bound for sea. Tug Ocean King standing by, 1613, tug Ocean King. Okay, done that. I go back over to this thing. So they've given me a jingle telling me they're ready. Bang! This is a what's called a Fairbanks Morse opposed piston engine. It is a massive piece of equipment. I've seen them since. And the whole tug just kind of tips a little bit in reaction to the torque reaction to the propeller turning. And we push ahead, and the barge folds in just the way we were hoping. The line up in front goes slack. The captain lifts it off. Hey, this is working great. Bong! And it stops. And there, you have never heard more intimidating silence than when you're maneuvering a boat and the engine is off. All there is this hmm of the generator, you know, it's seemingly in another county. And so I waited for a little while, and sure enough, the tide lifted it off, and the captain walked back to the stern where our other line was up, and everything was going quite well. And so I bong, and it pushed ahead. And the line went slack, and the captain picked it off and threw it down on the barge. Barge turned around. We went downriver. It was like magic. One of the best moments of my life.
We'll have more from Salted Tales, Stories from the Sea Told Live, on the next edition of Mid-Coast Currents on May 15th. The event was held at the Colonial Theater in Belfast and co-sponsored by the Penobscot Marine Museum. And that's Mid-Coast Currents for today. I'm Amy Brown, filling in this month. Join us again next month here on Community Radio WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill and 99.9 Bangor.